the winning of the West, or the invasion of the West, or the stealing of the West. That is our subject tonight. Depends upon your viewpoint, I suppose. And we are joined by three men who know a great deal about the history of the American West and its settlement. Landon Jones is the former vice president for strategic planning at Time Magazine, at Time Incorporated. But before that, he was the editor of Money Magazine and then of People Magazine. And he's a history buff. As an author, he turned out a few years ago The Essential Lewis and Clark, that being an anthology based upon the Lewis and Clark journals. And he's the author right now of an article in the current issue of Smithsonian Magazine about William Clark, the elder of the two intrepid explorers who were the first Americans to go overland to the West Coast. Robert Galler is the interim director of the Darcy McNichol Center for American Indian History at the Newberry Library. And he has been visiting professor of history at Western Michigan University and at Grand Valley State University. And rounding out our panel is an old friend, Richard Van Orman, who is professor of history at Purdue and a great expert on the history of the West. One of his books combines the West and Africa. It's titled The Explorers, 19th Century Expeditions in Africa and the American West. But I was tantalized or really fascinated by something that I think Robert Galler said, or was it Richard Van Orman? I'm not sure, just before when we were sitting in the so-called green room. Namely that the West isn't really the West. It's the North or the South for many of the people who went into it.
Yeah, when you start thinking about the West, we often think about everyone moving from East to West. But what we really have with a lot of the earlier non-Indians in the West were people coming from Canada, people coming from Mexico. And to them, they were going to the South or to the North, depending on their direction. So the West is really depending upon where you're looking for. Much of American history has been presented as coming from the East, but there's no reason why we shouldn't look at it from a lot of different angles.
Were they coming in from Canada as early as Americans were coming from the East? I know that the Hispanic settlement in the Southwest even predates our stretch out to the West, but when were the Canadians coming down?
Oh, people are starting to come down from Canada early on. I mean, the Courier de Bois were coming in with the French early on in the 1700s and before. And, I mean, we've got different records of people coming at different times, but it was a long process that went well beyond the time when the French were technically in control of part of Canada. So it's a long history.
When do Americans really begin to move west? We know that Lewis and Clark sort of point the way, but you don't get an immediate rush of immigration westwards after Lewis and Clark, do you?
At the time of the fur trade, that was just beginning. And when Lewis and Clark came back from their successful expedition to the Pacific in 1806, on the way back, they met boats coming out loaded up with fur traders who were organizing the first fur trade expeditions up to upper Missouri and into the Rocky Mountain West. And it was the fur trade, which is sort of economic incentive, that initially poured a lot of people west into the Indian country, into Indian lands. And at that time, I find it helpful, picking up on Rob's point, to think of the West as a borderland or a contested lands, and that when many, many different forces are operating, the Canadians, the Indians owned it and resided there. The Russians were coming, the Hispanics were coming up from the South.
The Russians, you say?
The Russians were fur trading up and down the Pacific Northwest at the time of and immediately after Lewis and Clark.
Where were they coming from? Not from Russia.
Yes.
The way?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Crossing over Alaska?
Crossing over at the Bering Sea and Alaska. Yeah.
They were moving down to California with Fort Ross. And they were very, very concerned about the encroachments upon their territory by outsiders, namely the English and the Americans. So we have a sort of early Cold War there between the Russians and the United States.
You mean we had official Russian settlements?
Yes.
In the West?
Yes.
Credited by the Tsarist regime as part of Russia?
It began in the Peter the Great and continued into the 19th century.
Most of these were seafarers, I think, went to Dick.
Vitus Bering was the first.
They weren't marching down the coast, but they were in trading vessels.
The sea otter trade and the fur trade, the beaver trade, certainly encouraged them to continue.
You, Landon, have done work on Lewis and Clark. You edited a popular edition of their journal. And I know that you're now working on a biography of Clark. An interesting chapter from that biography has just appeared in the Smithsonian Magazine, and that follows Clark in his post expedition career, which is quite fascinating.
Yes.
But let's go to the expedition itself. It's conceived or it's ordered by Jefferson as president, isn't it?
Yes. Jefferson had been fascinated with the Trans-Mississippi West for a long time, and he thought that the West could be reached and conquered very easily, that the Rockies would be mountains not unlike the Blue Ridge Mountains near his home in Charlottesville. And so it would be a simple portage over there, and once we got there, we could lay claim to the trade with the Far East from the Pacific. And it was largely an economic incentive that made him want to go there. But he did not envision the Rocky Mountains as the multiple ranges we know now and the great roaring free streams of the West. He thought they would be more like the Potomac.
And he commissions a bright young fellow who's working for him as a sort of secretary in the White House to do the expedition.
He asked Lewis to do it. Previously, he had even discussed it with George Rogers Clark 20 years earlier, who was Clark's older brother. And at one point, when he was in Paris as an ambassador to France, he talked to an American adventurer named John Ledyard about his crazy scheme to get to the Pacific coast by way of Russia and cross over the Bering Strait. But it was the first time it got organized was with Lewis, and he wrote a secret message to Congress in January of 1803 asking for a couple $1,000 to authorize this expedition.
And Lewis chooses Clark, who is a friend of his, I gather.
Lewis knows Clark because they both served in the Indian War in the Ohio Valley together, and Clark was about 4 years older than Lewis and was really an experienced military man. He had led expeditions, he had built forts, he had supplied people, he had fought with the Indians, he had seen combat with Indians, and he was not necessarily a friend of the Indians even then, and his older brother George Rogers Clark was an avowed enemy of the Indian population.
Got a wonderful quotation here from the Journal of Meriwether Lewis. This is 6 days after he became the first American to cross the Continental Divide. The expedition starts in 1803. They cross the divide in 1805.
In the summer of 1805.
Yeah. Here's what he's saying a few days after that. This day I completed my 31st year. I reflected that I had as yet done but little, very little indeed, to further the happiness of the human race or to advance the information of the succeeding generation. I viewed with regret the many hours I have spent in indolence, and now I sorely feel the want of that information which those hours would have given me had they been judiciously expended.
It's a remarkable quotation from a man at what should have been a peak moment in his life. And it accounts for some of the reasons that Jefferson later, after Lewis died of a suicide in 1809, just 3 years after the expedition, and Jefferson commented about that, saying that Lewis had a melancholic disposition for which he was well known. This may be an example of that. For about half of the days of the expedition, Lewis did not keep a written record of what he was doing that we know of, whereas Clark very faithfully, very dutifully kept one every single day.
What do we know about how much privation and difficulty they faced and about their relationship with the Indians, who essentially sustained them in that long journey, didn't they?
The story is an amazing story. It's almost unbelievable. It's almost fiction. As far as the tribes, there were a number of tribes that they went through, dealt with. Some would say 50, 60 tribes approximately. In all those encounters, those potential dangerous encounters, they only had one of great seriousness, and that was with the Blackfeet. There were other potential dangers along the way, and there could have been a mistake, and there could have been disaster. But one of the amazing things is how well, diplomatically, they handled those very potentially dangerous situations by having York along. York was the slave, the black slave of William Clark. Like earlier Estevan with Fray Marcos in New Spain, York was a fantastic image to the Indians. They tried to wash off his blackness because they thought underneath there must be some other kind of skin color. And his effect on them is an important one. Plus, these two men were just made for this trip. I can't think of any other explorers, perhaps Stanley Livingston, Speke, people of Africa, who went through greater difficulties, obviously, than the Americans did. But I can't think of two more effective men working in tandem than Lewis and Clark.
How many men were along on the expedition?
at the end of approximately 30-33, they had separated, segued away some of the earlier ones who weren't doing too well or who were not necessarily to go all the way with them. It was a trial and error part of the earlier part of the expedition, but then they decided about 33, and you have to add to York to the story of the Sacagawea, the bird woman. Here we have a black man and a female, an Indian Shoshone girl, who was in the 17, 18 year old, I guess, something like that, who was carrying a papoose and who was extremely important to that trip. So we have, in a sense, a most interesting and 20th century type situation with a black man and a Shoshone Indian woman playing important roles for these two white men and their successful trip.
In a way, it's kind of a microcosm of the West in general. We think of, if we look at it as an intercultural community, I mean, the Lewis and Clark journey was truly that, with the different people that were there, both who were on the trip and then who they met along the way. I mean, we can talk about them as meeting Native Americans, but the difference between tribes on the West Coast versus the Mandan and Hidatsas versus the Lakotas that they run across is very different too. So, I mean, you've got the Native American perspective, but I mean, that includes so many different things as well. So it really is a kind of an interesting whole setup for what is the West today too.
When the expedition is over and they get back to St. Louis, I guess, and then on to Washington for further the reports, and they write up some of the reports, what's the immediate consequence, or is there not an immediate consequence?
The immediate consequence was great excitement in the press, and people reported upon this, upon the marvelous heroes. It was a great adventure, and it was recognized as an adventure. But when people talked about it, they didn't quite really know what to celebrate. Was it that they had been to the Pacific? Well, yes, that was wonderful. But Americans had been to the Pacific already in boats. When you looking at it now, the Lewis and Clark expedition was to some degree immediately seen as a failure. That Jefferson wanted an easy route to the Pacific. Lewis and Clark certainly did not find that. They found a very complicated route. They were the last people to go that way. Most of the later exploration trails were over South Pass, a place that Lewis and Clark never discovered at all. Did they claim the Pacific Northwest for the burgeoning American Republic? Not at all. It was contested. Oregon was contested for another 50 years. So did they set up the fur trade? No, the fur traders were heading up the river as Lewis and Clark were coming back. And by the mid-19th century, they were largely forgotten. It wasn't really until 100 years later, at the 100th anniversary of the expedition, that it came back into focus as a, and then it was celebrating more the American empire.
So their expedition and the report of it did not stir strong patterns of immigration from east to west?
I don't think so, no.
When does that begin? When do Eastern Americans really begin to move west?
1830s, 1840s, some trips have been made, some journeys have been made, some books have been written, the newspapers are beginning, the penny press is beginning, so more and more people are reading about the West never before. They're coming back with the prairie dogs and coyotes and things like that, a zoological excursion in a sense. That's when the newspapers begin to play it up. That's when politicians begin to play it up. When you have newspapers and politicians playing it up, you know there's going to be excitement.
A great American quotation is Horace Greeley talking to, I'm not sure, but some younger person apparently, "Go west, young man, and grow up with the country." But he says that in 1851. So there's still
late.
A certain amount of urging of people to the West.
Yeah, really, he's a little late, but he's on the right track, and that's certainly a very important boom time at the midpoint of the century. But I want to say one thing, though, that this is an important way to begin a century. First, we have the election contested somewhat of Thomas Jefferson, 1800. Then 3 years later, we have this tremendous explosion in land with the Louisiana Purchase, a penny an acre. And then a year or two later, the Lewis and Clark expedition. No century in our past, or a few nations' centuries, have begun with such august and significant seismic earthquakes as that one did.
And then some 20 years later, we've got a president, Andrew Jackson, who really takes a very strong position about pushing the Indians off their land and expanding American control of what we now call the Midwest, and sets the pattern for the ultimate conquest of the whole continent.
The Trail of Tears.
And it's the Trail of Tears. We do that at heavy cost to all of the Indian tribes.
Sure. I mean, and in a way, just to bring it back to Lewis and Clark a little bit more, I mean, you can really see the Lewis and Clark journey as a possibility for great opportunities. I mean, these folks could have created some great alliances with people. But in a way, you look at their long trip on their way up, and then quickly, once they reached their goal, they quickly came back. Conflicts with Blackfeet on the way back, and really they lost some opportunities as well, and it sort of sets the stage for what is, as you say, you know, their whole removal process, which, I mean, we look at the Trail of Tears in the late 1830s, but, I mean, this is something that goes on basically through most of the 19th century.
Yeah, I think an important point to get at here is that it was not an empty continent. It was a continent that was occupied by indigenous tribes who'd been there for a long time. It was a crowded wilderness. And Lewis and Clark depended upon the kindness of strangers who met them along the way to take care of them. And there couldn't really be vast waves of immigrants right after Lewis and Clark, because they didn't own the land, and no one could protect them if they tried to go out there. The British were still fighting up there in the upper Midwest, just, you know, not too far from here at the same time. And so it really wasn't until after the War of 1812, and then after the well-publicized explorations by, you know, John Wesley Powell and John Charles Fremont and the Gold Rush, that suddenly the rush got serious. And then as you point out, with Andrew Jackson, we got serious about alas, seeing the Indians as obstacles and basically moving them out of the way.
And we will continue the story from that point right after we pause to do a little... Some of them did fur trading. We trade time for money. And we'll pause briefly to honor one of our trades, and then we'll be directly back to Landon Jones, Robert Geller, and Richard Van Orman. And we return to Robert Geller, to Richard Van Orman, and to Landon Jones. Landon was saying, just before we stopped for commercials, that he characterized the West as significantly populated, as a crowded continent, I think he said. How crowded was it, Richard? What's the demographics? Can we put any numbers on this? If you go, say, to 1810 as compared to 1850, what different populations of what quantity are in existence in the American West during those two periods?
Well, I know the figure for 1860 for the Caucasian white population was about almost 5 million people. Most of them were on the west side of the Mississippi.
Yeah.
And the towns were basically mining camps that were springing up across the American West. California, of course, in the 1840s, Montana in the 1860s, Colorado in the 1850s. We have a continuous floating population of about 250,000 moving back and forth where the next boom is, which will end in a bust. So we have a very mobile population, of course, and a very aggressive population, and a young male population that brings on a great deal of violence, because there's no constraints on them. There's no church, there's no family, there's no wife, there's no, you know, mother. They are free as a bird, and they have a 45.
It's testosterone territory.
Yeah, exactly, and a 45 adds to that.
But if you go back to 1810, when there were very few Caucasians from the East Coast of the United States crossing the Mississippi, how many Indians were there, in fact, whether in the total continental United States or, for that matter, west of the Mississippi? How crowded was that continent?
It's a matter of great scholarly debate as to how much it is. And one of the myths that we have is that it was an empty wilderness to begin with, because we don't want to face the fact as to how many people died as a result of the contact between the two civilizations. I mean, the estimates I hear were that sort of pre-Columbian indigenous aboriginal population, and Robert, maybe you can help me on this one, I think it's around 4 million. Of whom maybe 90% ultimately
it's perished. 4 million in what became the continental United States.
North of Mexico.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And that the population density in the Americas was as great as that of Europe. But this is a very hard idea for us to accept and to understand, because then you really see what is happening as an invasion.
But that number's
one population
changed,
invading another.
I mean, and as you say, I mean, that number's changed through generations. A generation or two ago, people were just talking about, oh, maybe several hundred thousand, and it would therefore, in a way, maybe get people off the hook for the results of what's
happening. But the acceptable scholarly estimate now is around 4 million?
The early million, yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know the exact
no
number.
One really
but,
knows.
I mean,
some of this,
no one knows.
They go back and forth with this. Those who feel that this was aggressive and a disaster to the Indians usually heighten the figure a little bit. Those others who are on the more cautious side put it down to 2 and 3 million. But the important thing is that the population is depleted very rapidly.
Well, Richard just said by some 90% of the total population.
The depletion from smallpox, from diphtheria, from measles.
Basically disease rather than
exactly
being shot in the face.
And particularly in this time period you're talking about, I mean, the early 19th century, is a lot of things are coming up the Missouri River after a while. And certainly the groups like the Mandans and Hidatsas relocated further north, and that was because they had lost a lot of their populations further south. And some groups therefore start to mingle together, and, you know, for alliance purposes. And, you know, it's a tough time for a lot of groups. Some groups are who are less connected to the river don't face that as quickly, but they all face it at some point.
I just had occasion the other day on our website, with reference to some other matter, to quote the great lyric from one of Woody Guthrie's songs: "The banker robs, the bandit robs you with a gun, the banker with a fountain pen." How did we rob the Indians? It was partly with guns. It was partly also with fountain pens. That is to say, we got them to sign treaties in which they surrendered their land.
Well, William Clark, after the expedition, signed more treaties than any American diplomat with sovereign nations. And in his case, the sovereign nations were the Indian tribes. He must have signed 30 or 40
He became the governor
treaties.
Of the, what do they call that territory?
Yes, he was governor of what was first called Louisiana Territory, and then was called Missouri Territory. Right.
And then he was the chief Indian agent.
And then he was
the
chief Indian agent for long after that. For 30 years, he was the chief representative of the federal government in the West in all its dealings with the Indian tribes.
And he kept speaking for the Great White Father.
He interpreted the desires of the American government to the Indians. He also interpreted the Indians to the European Americans as well. He was a man in the middle who talked to both sides and tried. And he was, I think, a good man and tried to act in a more responsible way and be a good American. And he never really could solve the dilemma that he had to face, which is that we wanted their land. And how he did that was by bit by bit bargaining, making them bargain away their rights to the land and to the hunting. And they were liquor was used when it had to be used, promises were made that were broken, wars were the moment a treaty was signed, the settlers would usually quickly violate it, move into the land that was supposed to be the Indians. The Indians would retaliate. And then as the punishment for retaliation, we would march in and make them sign another more punitive treaty.
And you run into the big issue of interpretation that's going on. First of all, interpreters, how good are they? I mean, you know, bad interpreters can be problematic, and that certainly happens. And, you know, you read about that in a lot of cases. You also have the whole issue of the different cultures, if we can simplistically think about native cultures versus European-American, but the value of the written word versus the oral word. For native peoples, in some cases, a conversation or an interaction, the oral conversation was important. To the Americans, often, no matter what you talked about, if somebody signed on a paper, the paper was important. And where they placed the value, was it in the conversation or was it in the document? Mm. The Americans said, you can talk whatever you want, but it's written in the document, and people aren't understanding things, so they misinterpret. And you have one faction signing for what another faction has control of, and that's a big problem.
I've got a fascinating text here, but I know that this man, Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce, has had some things attributed to him that he did not actually say. Is this authentic, or is it somebody's invention of attributed to him? He's quoted as saying, "If we ever owned the land, we own it still, for we never sold it. In the treaty councils, the commissioners have claimed that our country had been sold to the government. Suppose a white man should come to me and say, 'Joseph, I like your horses, and I want to buy them.' Then he goes to my neighbor and says to him, 'Joseph's horses, I want to buy them,' but he refuses to sell. My neighbor answers, 'Pay me the money, and I will sell you Joseph's horses.' The white man returns to me and says, 'Joseph, I have bought your horses, and you must let me have them. If we sold our lands to the government, this is the way they were bought.'" Is that an accurate quotation?
Well, whether you said it or not, it's accurate in what we did to the Indians. And I think it sums up very effectively the feeling that the Indians had about the white man. We treat them as children. We call them children. And we make promises that we don't keep. And nobody expected, Milt, this whole thing would happen so quickly. Jefferson was talking about generation after generation, the slow, gradual movement westward. But this thing began to blow up by the 1830s and 40s, and there was little time to deal with it in a comprehensive, intelligent manner.
Were there promptings of conscience? Did anyone speak in terms of condemnation of what was government policy and what was actually happening?
I know that after the treaty William Clark signed with the Osage Indians in Missouri, which for about $1,500 and the use of a blacksmith and a couple of hundred dollars in annual annuities, the Osage basically destroyed their culture. They gave up all their lands in the state of Missouri. They were moved out of the state, and it was a disaster for their civilization. Later, Clark commented to his friend Ethan Allen Hitchcock that if he would be damned in hell, it would be because of that treaty he had signed with the Osage. And so he knew that he had been no friend to the tribes at that time, and he suffered pangs of conscience when the Indians were being moved across the Mississippi River before and during the Trail of Tears period, that he would often find ways to give them money, food, clothing, shelter, and help them as best he could. But these were small things in the middle of what was a calamity for these civilizations.
If we go a few decades further forward beyond, say, 1850 and beyond the Civil War, we get a whole new surge of Western settlement once the war is over. And we know that period better. We've got a great American, it's either a mythology or it's, in fact, an accurately, more or less accurately told tale, but we get it from many sources, including, of course, the movies, which have given us an image of the West which is indelible. Our image of the West would not be the same if John Ford had fallen off a bar stool early in his career and cracked his head, it seems to me. And if John Wayne hadn't played the roles he did and played them so well, and Clint Eastwood playing his roles somewhat later on. We've got commercials coming right now. I mean to ask you when we return to compare the West of narrative representation, whether mythic or otherwise, in film, and for that matter in much novel writing, Louis L'Amour and people of that sort. Compare that West to what we know about the real West, say 1870, circa 70, 80 and thereabouts. We go directly back to Geller, Van Orman and Jones after this. And we return to Robert Geller, who is the interim director of the Darcy McNichol Center for American Indian History at the Newberry Library. It's one of the great collections, in fact, in the country. Richard Van Orman, who is professor of history with a special focus upon the history of the American West at Purdue University, the Calumet campus, and Landon Jones, who comes to us for quite a number of years. He was at Time Incorporated, where he served last as vice president for strategic planning. Before that, he was the editor of Money Magazine and of People Magazine. He's an author and researcher working as a freelance person now. An earlier book is The Essential Lewis and Clark, and a new biography of William Clark is in the works. One chapter from that is to be found in the current issue of Smithsonian Magazine. It's about the post-expeditionary career of William Clark, about which we spoke just a bit a moment ago. So let's go, say, to 1865, 1870, and from 65 to 80, perhaps, when there's an awful lot of movement from east to west. And that's the period that our films have focused on, our westerns. And we get a sense of a kind of culture where there are little towns, a lot of gambling, a few floozy women, and one or two decent ones who somehow have blundered in, and a preacher trying to get a church started, a few women in bonnets who walk around and represent civilization, but there are ruffians and rowdies who kill each other in bars until somebody comes along, some stranger, who is intrinsically a noble person, and he somehow turns the town around, perhaps serving as sheriff, though he faces great dangers in doing so. And beyond that little town with its rickety structures, nothing but desolation in all directions. Deserts and sagebrush blowing across the plains. That's the West of, say, 1870. How accurate is it, Richard?
Well, I hate to destroy myth in the first hour of the show, but it is. Violence was very, very much a part of the West, as I just mentioned earlier, with the youth and the 45 and booze and gambling and no women. But we don't care about that kind of violence. We want the shootouts, the gunfight, as typically represented by Hickok and David Tutt in Springfield, Missouri. This was the first shootout in Springfield, Missouri, the home of Ozark music, the OK Corral. That's the image we have, in a sense, been given, and the image has stuck because it represents success, it represents quickness, it represents manliness, it represents bravery, and it represents the gun. which is one of the most important symbols. I think the covered wagon, the stagecoach, and the gun are the three basic symbols of the American West. If you want to add a few more, it's perfectly all right with me. So this image that began around 1900 has continued across America into the 21st century with this caveat. The Western, as you and I knew it back in the glorious days of the 1940s and 50s, the days of Ford and Mann and Howard Hawks and Bill Wyler, those days are gone because the Western is basically gone. And of course, there's a new discussion on what happened to the Western. That's a new program perhaps for next month. But the Western as we knew it, as you and I knew it, has by and large dissipated and disappeared. Why? In part because Star Wars has moved in, cop shows have moved in, and where's Gary Cooper and John Wayne when we need him?
Well, we've had Clint Eastwood, who among, apart from his Dirty Harry films, has
one
done
man.
A number of Western films.
He's like a lone cowboy coming into town.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood in Hollywood is that lone gunman, except for him.
Mostly his Western towns are in Italy, as a matter of
That's
fact.
That's right.
But not that last one, which is very different from the others.
Unforgiven?
Unforgiven, The Unforgiven.
Yeah, that was an important 1990s film.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you, when you look at the movies and say, how did they misrepresent the West, the thing that is most striking to me is that they portray the Indians as bandits and other people unlike us. When in fact, most of the Indians were not nomads chasing buffalo, but they were agricultural, sedentary Indians who had advanced sort of farming know-how. They had sophisticated cultures in place with great resources to raise corn, squash, pumpkins, beans, you know, the essentials of Indian life. And they were far more like us than they were different from us. We dressed like them. That the frontiersmen aped the style of Indian dress, the buckskins and the leggings and the hunting shirt, and likewise the Native Americans adopted many of the dress of the Europeans, the hats, the coats, the shirts, that it was so interlocked and we were so much alike And it almost seems a crime to portray the Native Americans as a lawless bandits when in fact that they were so similar.
Well,
do
you get events like the absolutely required one in a John Ford, early John Ford film, the settlers coming across in their covered wagons and they're raided by Indians and so the wagons are drawn up in a circle and the Indians keep whooping around and they're shot down by John Wayne and by Ward Bond. But that's a required scene in many of those films. Did events of that sort actually happen?
There are cases where those happen, but if you think of percentage-wise, and I don't know what the numbers are, I mean, it's a real small amount of people who are actually hurt in those cases. It seems to me what those movies really do is show Native peoples as the only thing they seem to do in those films are attack. We get no sense of many of the other things, as we're just saying. I mean, Langdon talks about this cooperation that's going on, and clearly that's happening. I mean, there's this conflict as well, but we get a sense of, and maybe it's the preoccupation with military history, that the fighting is what happens all the time, as if people get up every morning and try to fight. And in reality, it's a small part of it, but there's no context to those movies, so we presume, and that's the only image Americans got, was that Native people were fighting.
Well, we have little wars in which cavalry regiments led either by John Wayne or by Henry Fonda march out of the fort and attack Indians who represent a danger.
You know, Ford had a transitional episode because by the time he retired, by the time he died, he was somewhat aghast at some of those scenes and did a movie called Cheyenne Autumn,
mm-hmm.
in which the Indians were finally depicted in a much more humane way. I think Ford had second thoughts about some of those earlier films in which the Indians were often villains. And so as to make up for those errors of judgment, perhaps, or the prejudices that he showed, typically American, he was trying to restate the situation in a more favorable Indian light.
By the time you reach the end of the period I'm talking about, say 1880, what is the situation of the Indians of the West? What is the degree of construction of something like the outlines of a stable society in the West by the Caucasians? How different is 1880, say, from 1860 or 1865?
I mean, by 1880, a lot of people had been relocated onto reservations. There's a sense of, you know, despair in a lot of cases, but there are also a lot of people who are still, you know, acting on their own accord. They may be placed on at agencies, on reservations, but they still are trying to adapt to what's going on at that point.
And they're restive and they break out.
There are those things. I mean, people still need to survive, and some hunting parties still take place, but the efforts more and more are to push people onto reservation areas or agencies. And also by that point, particularly on the plains, I mean, the main source of food had been destroyed. A lot of the buffalo were gone at that point. So there was less of a reason. And, you know, because of a lot of different things that took place, people were forced to rely upon certain rations.
Now, what about white and black settlement? Do we have any, by 1880, do we have any significant population centers which are stably established? Cities or of some significant size, commerce, et cetera,
St. Louis, Kansas City, Denver, Los Angeles, San Francisco,
Omaha.
The Texas cities of Austin,
railroad terminus, right?
Dallas, they're beginning to build up. Seattle, of course, named after Chief Seattle, appropriately. These are all thriving communities and becoming.
And when does the Transcontinental Railroad get completed? When do they drive that golden
1869,
spike?
1869.
May 10th.
As early as 69.
At 7 a.m., I think it was. May 10th, 1869, that famous photograph, which they changed because everybody was drinking in the first photograph, so they had to do another one.
I didn't know that.
Mel, to go back to a point that you were asking about the myth of the West and talking about the cities that we were discussing earlier, that the Mandan villages where Lewis and Clark spent the winter of 1804 and 05, near today's Bismarck, North Dakota, was a large, thriving city. I mean, there were Mandan and Hidatsa tribes were in that area, and Arikara were there, and they had 5,000 people or so in one area there.
Larger than the St. Louis that they had left.
St. Louis had 1,500 or 2,000. I mean,
yeah.
it was the biggest city in the west of today's United States. By the end of William Clark's life in 1838, that civilization had been basically wiped out by smallpox, and they were down from 5,000 to a couple of hundred at the most.
Is there anything to the story that one hears? I'm not sure of whom the story is told, but some military group giving the Indians blankets infected with smallpox, so that they are quickly killed off, at least in one particular locality. Did that actually happen?
The story is told that the British general considered that.
Oh, a British general.
And during either the French Indian War or the Revolution, I think it was the French Indian War, but was dissuaded from doing it because of the spread of that kind of disease could take off the good guys and the bad guys at the same time. So they didn't need to take any blankets from smallpox hospitals. Just by going west was sufficient.
Similarly, that you had a lot of depopulation, didn't you, of native Indians in what is now Mexico, just by contact with the conquistadors. They did not have immunities to the diseases that the Spaniards brought with them.
Talking about the cities, we have in Mexico City, which was called Tenochtitlan at that time, the head of the Aztec Empire with Montezuma, we have hundreds of thousands of people. And within a short time, they were mostly dead or had disappeared into the abyss because of the diseases and the ability of the conquistador on horseback with a saber.
I was just reading on my computer just a few hours ago something that came to me in email, some left-wing organization that offers many speakers in favor of paying reparations to American blacks for slavery. That's a campaign that's underway. There's going to be a big march in Washington shortly along those lines. And one wonders, reading that, well, if we give reparations to African Americans, that's in addition to the reparations we paid by about 750,000 people giving their lives during the Civil War to end slavery. But if we give reparations to African Americans, aren't we also certainly required to give reparations to American Indians?
This began with the Japanese payment of $20,000 to the Japanese who suffered from the relocation concentration camps of the 1940s, and that idea was picked up by some black leaders, and certainly they have moved it along very rapidly, but I think there's a great deal of disagreement with that policy. And you're right, if we open that box, we will have the Indians coming to us, rightfully so, and saying, look what you did to us 100, 200 years ago.
And Indian people, of course, are today with all the problems with the finances from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, with land claims and all kinds of things. Money has been lost, documents have been lost, and the supposed protection of the BIA to watch over people's lands and accounts just is lost. And, you know, clearly that's a big problem for people in reservation communities today in terms of, you know, where are the records that say what they have? And, you know, and people are looking into that more and more today. So, I mean, even that as a base level, not to mention reparation beyond, would be another whole
thing. And on top of that, Milt, they're asking for a return of their lands, specific lands that in some cases are going to court now, and in some cases perhaps they will achieve their success of regaining the lands. Of course, the casino business is very profitable to them, so at least in that area they're making some money.
Also, there's some justice in the fact that in the case of the Maine Indians and the Passamaquoddy and the Penobscot of New England, that the money they had to start the casinos came from a land settlement that was made in Maine with the tribes there. So however you may feel about the casinos, at least there's some justice in the fact that the Indians are getting something that was due to them.
Do you remember that movie, Northwest Passage, with Spencer Tracy fighting the Abenaki?
Yes, he's, what was the name of the character he plays? The head of the...
Richard Rogers.
Richard Rogers of Rogers Rangers.
Right.
I mean, the whole other thing with finances, I think it's important to keep in mind is, in many cases, of course, the government wanted to pay off. And in case of the Sioux with the Black Hills, they certainly decided that we don't want the money, we want the land. So the money is still sitting there because, you know, the issues of finances versus the cultural impact of land is
What is the current census of American Indians and Native Americans? That is, those who so identify and who live
self-identified,
a
little
life.
Over 2 million, 2.1, 2.2, something.
So it has
like
risen
that.
A good deal in
significantly,
the last
yeah.
20 or 30 years.
Right. I mean, the lowest point was probably at the turn of the 20th century, a couple hundred thousand.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's grown a lot there, and that has to do with a lot of different things, of course.
Gentlemen, we pause for the usual reasons, and we'll shortly be back to Landon Jones, Robert Geller, and Richard Van Orman. First, these words. With a quick reintroduction of our guests, Richard Van Orman, professor of history at Purdue University, Calumet, Robert Geller, interim director of the Darcy McNichol Center for American Indian History at the Newberry Library, Landon Jones, a freelance writer, former executive at Time Incorporated, and a student of Western history with a particular focus upon Lewis and Clark. And we will be turning to your phone calls in about 10 minutes. We're opening the lines right now. The number, of course, is 591-7200. You can't really do the history of the West and its settlement in a two-hour program with six commercial breaks, so there's a great deal we haven't talked about. Thus, any question you'd like to raise is more than welcome. 591-7200. And 312, of course, the area code if you're calling long distance. If you're at a very long distance on either coast or up in Canada or down in Mexico or on some other continent and listening to us on the Internet, you can reach us via email. The email address, extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720, as one word, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, on to the phones and to some email, probably, when we negotiate the last phase. You were saying, again, I think during a commercial break, Richard, that another important juncture is around the turn of the century, around 1900.
Yeah, a great change is taking place in America, of course. In 1890, we find out from the Census Bureau that the frontier is gone, and that led in part to the Turnerian thesis about the significance of the frontier in American history, given at the Art Institute down the street here in 1893. But also beyond those points, the Buffalo Bill and the Pony Bill Wild West shows were extremely popular. They had resuscitated interest in the West as few other things could at that time. They brought Sitting Bull out of retirement. They did the Deadwood stage. It was really a spectacular, and Buffalo Bill came out as a half-man, half-god image of a Western frontiersman. That went through until 1917 when he died. He was very popular with Queen Victoria, in fact. And then we have 1902, Owen Wister, this Easterner, writing about the Virginian. which has been made into a play and at least four movies, one starring Joel McRae and the other Gary Cooper. And then finally, on top of those items, ingredients, this pie of the West, we have the issue of changes taking place in America based on other factors like the movies. And as you know, Milt, the West is the movie. The movie is the West. A Rose is a Rose. The movie is the West. We have the great train robbery made in the wilds of New Jersey that depicts, obviously, a train robbery, but was the first. There was something with a bar room in Bismarck, I think, before this, but this really begins the movie love affair with the American Western, a love affair that lasted 60, 70 years. Until finally there was a divorce around 1970 that really hasn't been put together ever since. So in that period, Milt, we have a great deal of emphasis on cultural change and emphasis on the American West.
To what degree is the culture of the West different, even to this day? Perhaps only in superficials, perhaps in mode of dress and manner of speech, and in some attitudes that are characteristic of certain populations. To what degree is the culture of the West distinctive as compared to the culture of the rest of the country?
In a way, I mean, the West, of course, with the open spaces, has a big impact on people. I mean, people mm-hmm. think nothing living in the West. I know, living in the West myself, 2-hour drives are nothing. You go 4 hours back and forth. I mean, there's a whole different concept of space that's there that is important. You know, people can travel great distances. I mean, that's an important part. And just the landscape. I mean, when you're on the plains and you can kind of see the weather coming across, that has that has an impact on your whole attitude toward the world and how you see yourself. I think that's all kind of part of the Western mindset.
I think another aspect of it is the ability of people always who come there to persuade themselves that they can reinvent themselves there. The people still are trying to go west, young man.
It's a new start sort of place, isn't it?
A new start sort of place. I spent a good part of the year in Bozeman, Montana, which is a beautiful town. But it has there's sort of a dark underbelly at Bozeman, which is that a lot of people come there with this sort of crazy dream that they're going to reinvent themselves there. They're going to become cowboys or championship skiers or have a fly fisherman and have a wonderful, different, new life there. And they quickly sort of fall to the bottom or the outskirts of society there, and there's a lot of sort of social malaise there. There are children growing up in abusive homes and homelessness, and it's all there too. And I've seen that just recently. It's sort of an unreported story in a place like mm-hmm. Bozeman or Aspen or Santa Fe, which is the people who don't get rescued there.
You know, you're suddenly bringing a memory to my mind. This is trivial, but I can't resist telling it to you. I was flying to Missoula, Montana, quite a number of years ago to give an academic lecture. And the plane was sort of hopping from Bismarck on to various other places and stopped in Bozeman. I think I had a change in Bozeman. And on the plane was an Indian gentleman of senior years with his hair in a queue and a few beads on him or something, but looked quite dignified. As he got off the plane, somebody was on the ground said, "Hey, George, where have you been?" He said, "I've been to Washington to see the Great White Father." he was kidding the whole role in a way.
Yeah.
And I suppose that kind of mockery probably persists among Indian leaders, for all I know.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
The basic sort of underlying social trends that we've seen in the West for so long, so many of them are still there.
Yeah.
The Rob at the outset of the show talked about how that the prevailing pattern is not of movement in this country has not always been east to west. It's been north to south. That with the voyageurs and French Canadians coming down mm-hmm. and the Hispanic population rising from Mexico, and that still goes on today. That's the major demographic shift in this country.
Oh, absolutely.
It is the rise of the Hispanic population. And that is not new. That is old.
We're going to pause, take care of some commercials, and then right on to the phones. There's a great deal, as I said a moment ago, that we have not covered. Obviously, we can't cover it all or even most of it in just the limited time available. But your questions will aid us in focusing on yet some other aspects of Western history that deserve commentary. So get your questions ready and call them in. I see now we've got one line available again. For a while, they were all filled. The number 591-7200, 591-7200. 7200. If you hit the busy signal,
Don't be totally discouraged, but call again, particularly after we say goodnight to some prior caller. And, of course, the email is available to all and is of infinite capacity. The email address, extension 720, at tribune.com. We'll be directly on to your contributions after this. And we will go directly to the phones, 591-7200, the number. And here is the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Milt.
Yes,
pleasure
sir.
Being on your program. You know, it's funny. I lived in Utah for 6 years. And none of your panelists have mentioned the Mormons, Brigham Young, or Utah.
They're going to mention it now.
Yeah, that's Brigham Young probably was one of the most important European settler to come, of course, in 1847 and permanently settle the West. And I've often heard it say, and I'm not a Mormon, but I did live there for 6 years, that perhaps because of the Mormon religion and a lot of antipathy, he has not gotten the credit from historians and other prominent Americans for what he did. I'd like to hear your panel, what they want to say.
By all means.
Well, there's a lot of prejudice in the 19th century against the Mormons. Because of Brigham Young and Joseph Smith and the idea of plural marriage and their own little army that they had in Nauvoo. And there was a religious war going on between the Gentiles and the Mormons. So it's a very interesting story. It's a tragic story. But Young pulled them together, moved them out there in the 1840s, and settled Salt Lake City, hoping, like Jefferson earlier did, that he would be left alone, that the population would not increase rapidly. What did he see in the next few years? The tremendous migration going out to the West, to California. And then we had the Mormon War in the 1850s. Added to that, the Mountain Meadows Massacre, sure, in which Mormons were involved with Indians and killing some
settlers. What is the Mormon War of the 1850s?
That was a war in which the government of the United States felt that the Mormons were not loyal citizens, that they were aiding and abetting the Indians, and that the army under Albert Sidney Johnson would go out there and try to educate the Mormons and put any uprising that was talked about, any separateness that was talked about. This is the time of the beginning of secession. The South is talking about leaving. And by God, we don't want the Mormons to separate themselves from the rest of this nation. So there's a lot of fear and trepidation about the whole Mormon experience because of the earlier antipathy towards the Mormons.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, considering one time they had a territory that included present-day Nevada and Utah, and in many ways they were the first permanent European settlers in the West, I think their story in the Western march towards America is extremely important and extremely prominent, and I think that it should be expounded more, and whether they're right and wrong, and as I say, living there 6 years, I always like to tell my friends that, you know, Utah is not in the United States, but it is a different place. I just wanted to tell you my feelings about that.
And we appreciate your doing so. It's wonderful to share your feelings. And we go on to another caller. 591-7200 is the number. And here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for having me on. I'm fascinated and timely. I'm a native Californian who just finished Undaunted Courage, and I watched Red River on DVD this morning. So you can imagine how timely your show is.
Mm-hmm.
Being a native Californian, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the California Gold Rush, the impact, obviously, on the migration west, and the impact it still has today.
When does that Gold Rush begin?
1849. The Gold Rush brings lots of people, of course, to California.
They get there by boat going around...
Around
South America, don't they?
Yes. Yeah.
Actually, the gold was discovered 1848.
But the other people coming after it.
At Sutter's Mill, do I remember that correctly?
Correct.
Yeah.
It was certainly an explosion of population. We had seen nothing like that before. The migration was very hectic and based on images that were often false. This is the image of America's streets lined with gold. We sold that to the Europeans, and now we are believing it. People thought that they could sell their farm and just sort of pick up and go west, and they would find great riches, seven cities of gold, the image reoccurring in the 1840s. It was a very difficult trip. Many people died along the way, especially along the Panama route. They found the difficulties out there. These are farmers. These are men who have little experience in place of mining. But this is the image of America. Where the West is, there will I be, and I will be successful because of it. And many people failed because of it.
And one other aspect of that you see in the gold rush is at the beginnings of the environmental despoliation of the West is that the immense natural resources of the West are things that could be exploited economically, and very dangerously. You have hydraulic mining that came out of the gold rush and the sort of ravaging of much of the environment. There still remains, you know, with the extraction industries, a major environmental issue today.
As well as the native communities in California who were really hurt significantly. I mean, after a while, there are points where they were offering bounty on people, and there was some major depopulation that took place with some ravaging of the communities there. So that was pretty serious as well following that time in California.
Mm. One more quick name to throw out at you for a comment. Ishi.
The last of the wild Indians.
Yeah. Studied by Kroeber, as I remember.
That's right, Alfred Kroeber.
Yeah.
And his people were certainly of that group that ultimately lost out because of the growth.
What tribe did Ishi come from?
The Yahi.
The Yahi.
And wandered down into Oroville, California. There's still a monument there honoring where they found him, and then they took him to UC Berkeley, and he lived out his life
in the museum.
In the museum, and passed away, I think, 1911.
That's right.
Yeah. Who did the book on him? I think
Kroeber.
Kroeber.
Yeah.
Kroeber. No, but more recently, about 10 or 12 years ago, there was a book on him and his relation with Kroeber, as a matter of fact. Kroeber, I should make clear to those who may be wondering, was a famous American anthropologist who did a great deal of work. In a way, he was the leader of Indian anthropology in the country for a while, was he not?
Yes.
Our thanks to the caller, and directly and quickly on to another. I see that we've got loads of calls, but not much email. If you're listening to us over the Internet particularly, including those ladies in Australia who have a little luncheon club where they often listen to this program in Sydney, we'd love to hear from you, or rather read you on email, the email address extension720@tribune.com, extension720@tribune.com, or 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
My question, or my comment, would be, it was my understanding that the Oklahoma Territory was originally set up as the place to move the Native Indians onto, out of the other areas. And am I wrong in that assumption? And then if that was true, how is it that that area became opened up for European settlement?
Actually, Landon, your man, William Clark, pushed a lot of Indians into Oklahoma, didn't he?
Yes, the present-day Oklahoma and Kansas were the sites designated for the settlement of tribes moved from the east. And that involved, and Clark was very involved with effecting those movements. And one of the things he had to do was to then move tribes from those areas to other areas to make room for the tribes that were coming in so they wouldn't do battle against one another. And so the caller's premise is correct that it was set up for that purpose, as was a good part of Kansas.
What tribe was it that struck oil in Oklahoma and grew very wealthy?
The Osage.
The Osage?
Yeah.
But as far as how the American settlement got in there, I have not studied that specifically, but it would seem to be the same old story, which is that of white infringement upon native lands.
Well, I think your point with it's broader than Oklahoma. I mean, originally the idea was move native people west of the river, and then it was Kansas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma, and gradually it came down to Oklahoma, and then even Oklahoma wasn't enough, so it got smaller and smaller, so that gradual process.
Sir, thank you for the call.
All right, good night.
Where is the largest concentration of Indian population in the country now?
The largest population are the Navajos in the Southwest, which would include the Four Corners area, especially Arizona, New Mexico.
Their reservation is very sizable.
I think maybe it's the size of West Virginia or something like that. It's very large, yeah.
But it isn't populated uniquely by Navajo. There are lots of other Caucasians living there, are there not?
There are checkerboard areas, which has to do with land being sold and taken in different ways. But, I mean, then there are also the other native peoples of the Southwest, the Pueblo groups,
the
Apache
Zuni
groups, a whole bunch. But, I mean, the Navajos specifically are the largest group.
Mm-hmm. What's the Indian census in the state of Illinois? Do we have any idea?
I'm not sure.
There are no reservations as such in Illinois, are there?
There are communities, but, yeah.
But there are up in Wisconsin. And Minnesota.
That's right, yeah.
We pause for a quick round of commercials. I see now one or two lines are available again. If you've been trying to reach us, move quickly and you may get through this time. 591-7200. And where is that email? The email address again, extension 720 at tribune.com. I want to hear from somebody living in the West and listening to us on email, listening to us on the internet at the moment. So that's extension 720 at tribune.com or 591-7200, right back after this. And we'll quickly reintroduce the guests and then right back to the phones. Those guests are Landon Jones, a former executive at Time Magazine, former editor of People Magazine and Money Magazine, but also in his spare time and now in his full time as a freelancer, a student of Western history, and the author earlier of The Essential Lewis and Clark, and now of a forthcoming biography of William Clark, though there is a chapter from the biography in the current issue of Smithsonian Magazine. Quite interesting indeed. I just read it today. Robert Geller is the interim director of the Darcy McNichol Center for American Indian History at the Newberry Library. He has served as a member of the faculty at both Western Michigan University and Grand Valley State University. And Richard Van Orman is a veteran academic, a professor of history at Purdue University, Calumet. One of his books is titled The Explorers, 19th Century Expeditions in Africa and the American West. Before we go back to the phones, I should really ask you, Robert, to say something about the Darcy McNichol Center. It's a great resource in Chicago. Lots of Chicagoans probably don't know about it.
Yeah, the Darcy McNichol Center is a research center, one of four at the Newberry Library, and our mission is basically to promote the use of collections. As you suggested briefly earlier, we've got one of the largest collections in the country of American Indian materials. And as a research center, what we try to do is get scholars to use the materials that are there, and we do that through programs. We just finished the Summer Institute. We have fellowships, we have workshops, and a speaker series during the academic year. So basically we're trying to bring people in to make use of the library, and we get some great scholarship. I mean, if you look through American Indian history, most of the, you know, significant works are connected to people who've been there.
What do non-scholars find at the Newberry relating to Indian history?
Well, we also have a public program office, and we have public programs annually. We've had a program called Winter, A Time of Telling, that we work with the American Indian Center and Nace College, and we bring in storytellers, and we also have the series of readings. We have authors coming in. Susan Power will be coming in the fall, and other people like that. So we bring in people that the general public will be interested in as well. We have a big conference planned in January in which we'll have some noted scholars coming in. Jack Forbes, Janine Pease, Pretty on Top, and Kate Shanley will be coming in and talking about American Indian history, literature. So we try to bring in a variety of people in that, that people will be interested in hearing.
I bet much of this is available on a website, is it?
Exactly.
And that website is?
www.newberry.org, N-E-W-B-E-R-R-Y.
And directly back to the phones now, 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I always appreciate your shows on history, and tonight is another one of the pearls in the wasteland of AM radio.
Well, it fascinates me, I confess. Go ahead, sir.
Regarding a book that I read a few years ago by Stephen Ambrose, Undaunted Courage,
mm-hmm.
I wonder if your guests have any comment about the book, given Ambrose's recent trouble with plagiarism. Was any of that book cobbed from another source?
Well, let's go first to Landon Jones on that.
I've read Ambrose's Undaunted Courage with a lot of interest, and it's one of the best things ever written about the journey of Lewis and Clark. Ambrose is a wonderful storyteller with a great gift at the summarizing anecdote that sort of gives you a feeling for what it was like to be there then. As for that is the one of his books that has not been named in any of the allegations of plagiarism involving his work. In Undaunted Courage, he is very careful to acknowledge some of the prominent Lewis and Clark scholars, and the best known of whom would be James Rhonda, a professor in Oklahoma, who wrote a wonderful book called Lewis and Clark Among the Indians. But Ambrose is quite careful and scrupulous. He will pick up a phrase or so from that book, and I've seen that, but it's always very carefully acknowledged. And so I think there really has been no problem with Undaunted Courage.
I think we all agree, we were talking about this a little bit before we came on the air, that the trouble he got into is probably more due to the fact that he employs a lot of other assistants who may, in fact, do some of the writing, or at least organize the material for him to write. And you lose touch with just where your material comes from if others have prepared it for you.
Well, he's turning out so many and so much material so quickly that you could put it on the basis that there's an oversight because of the speed of which his publications are coming. His son is a very important part of the cog. But again, the man has to take responsibility, and I think one of the problems with Ambrose is that he didn't want to take responsibility. He said, oh yeah, there are a few errors, but don't bother me with this nonsense. I've written 25 books, I make $5 million, and it's gone from there.
Hmm. Sir, we thank you for the call.
And thank you for taking me.
My pleasure, and we'll go directly to another. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi, marvelous show tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Invariably, when you think of post-Civil War America and the Indians, you think about Custer. And I wanted to ask your guests what they think about Custer as far as, was he a megalomania? Was he demented? Was he just following Army policy? And I ask that in reference to the fact that you mentioned movies before. Because I went to a Catholic grade school, and once every month, on the first Friday of every month, the nuns would treat us to a movie. And one of the movies I saw when I was 10 years old was Errol Flynn, They Died with Their Boots On.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to hear what they thought about Custer.
Any man who was fortunate enough to marry Olivia de Havilland can't be that crazy.
Tremendous.
There were a number of movies together, just to push the issue a little bit further. We have the Errol Flynn image, which I might add made Robert Utley one of the best Western historians, a Western historian, when he saw that movie back in the 1930s. And then we have Little Big Man, the other version of Custer, who is
quite the opposite,
completely
right?
Nuts.
Yes.
And
yes.
Should have been shot by a few Indians.
Right.
So I guess the truth, as they often say in history classes, is somewhere in between. He certainly was a brave man, and certainly probably a foolish man. He didn't listen to the scouts. They were telling him, big village, heap big village, and he divided his force, which is a no-no as well. And he had great ego and felt that he could take care of those Redskins, as he used to call them.
Did you feel he was like a megalomaniac or demented as little big man portrayed him to be, or
I think that was a little extreme, but I think he was a white soldier, as white soldiers were at that time, typically feeling that one white man could take 10 Indians, and now we have 300 with us, we could take 3,000 Indians, and don't tell me about those Indians, we'll take care of them. I did it before at Washita, I did it throughout the West, we will take care of them, don't worry, they'll run because their women are there, and it'll be a fight that we will have victory on our side.
Okay, thank you.
We thank you, sir. What was the role of Sitting Bull in that engagement?
Well, Sitting Bull was the head chief of the large encampment of rivers of Indians of, and I believe he was a Dakota Sioux.
Yes, he was a Hunkpapa Sioux.
A Hunkpapa Sioux, and who was on the Little Bighorn when Custer and his men arrived at the top of the hill. But there were other important chiefs there as well. Crazy Horse was there. Yeah.
Sitting Bull didn't really lead the war party. He was essentially performing religious functions, I've
read. He was more of a religious leader at that point, but he certainly was, as in many Indian cultures, religious leaders would have a high prominence.
But men like Gall was the famous the war chief at the time. There's a wonderful book, if anyone interested in the story of Custer and Little Bighorn should read Son of the Morning Star by Evan Connell, which mm-hmm. I think is one of the best books I ever read about the West.
What's the year of that battle?
Of that book?
Of that battle.
Well, 1876.
So it's really quite late in the history of the West.
It was one of the last important battles.
Yeah. Are there any after Little Bighorn itself?
Well, the famous one would be the Nez Perce March of the Nez Perce tribe led by Chief Joseph from their reservation in Idaho, where they that was in about in 1877. 77? Yeah. Oh, just a year later, excuse me.
And, I mean, of course, you have the massacre at Wounded Knee takes place after that still, too, in 1890. So there's a significant conflict that goes on throughout that time, even after then, but that's sort of a big point.
It's basically a mopping up operation. Chahani Mo goes off the reservation once in a while, and they send Miles and Crook down to bring him back, but it basically is over.
Wounded Knee is the last such engagement.
The last gasp.
591-7200 and to another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Yes, sir.
I can't tell you how long I've been waiting to drop a few names about with a Western connection on the radio or on television. And I will sort of give you a chance to choose who you would like to comment about.
You're giving us a cafeteria choice.
I'm glad you have about 20 minutes left on your program. The first one is Gustav Nordenskjold at Mesa Verde. Joseph Christmas Ives, who went up the Colorado River in the USS Engineer. John Strong Newberry and John McComb, who did the 1859 exploring expedition from Santa Fe to Moab. And John Evans, who was at the time the governor of Colorado, later the founder of Evanston, Illinois, and his role in the Sand Creek Massacre.
Well, as they used to say in the Army, you got me, Lieutenant, but probably my guess will have reference to some of those.
I thought Evans got involved with Evanston before he moved out to Colorado, but I'll listen to your correction. Yeah, Evans was the governor out there, Colorado Territory, at the time of the Indian difficulties with the Cheyenne and Arapaho. Some felt that he didn't do the job effectively to control that situation, and what we had here was a great deal of military preparation, and we sort of felt, the soldiers felt, these militiamen felt, that they had to attack the Indian village. That's why we were organized. And they found a man who agreed with them, and he was named John Milton Shivington, and a former Methodist minister. And they decided, for no good reason except because they were supposed to attack Indians, that they attack a camp on a settlement called the Sand Creek, where Black Kettle and his Cheyenne and Arapaho had put up an American flag and put up a white flag and felt protected. They were not very far from Fort Lyon, and they felt safe. But as I say, Shivington felt that we have these men, we have to use them, and so they attacked the village, killed about 100 men, women, and children, which launched a war, of course, in Colorado, which Evans had to pick up the pieces with.
Yes, but did Evans send them out into the field?
I would think Evans had responsibility in that situation, yes.
Are any of those other names known to members of this panel?
Ives and Newberry were explorers of the mid-period of the 19th century. They were not as famous as Fremont or Long or Pike or Lewis and Clark, but they did good work to help discover lands and open up the American West for the building of the railroad.
Who was that fellow with the German name that you started with, sir?
With Nordenskjold?
Yeah.
Gustav Nordenskjold was the young Swedish Swede who went to Mesa Verde after a long trip.
You know, we're not going to get the answer. Your phone is breaking up completely, so we're going to leave that as a total mystery. And anyone who really knows who that fellow was can email us or get in touch at some later date. Modern technology is just wonderful, but at times it makes communication impossible. Isn't that strange? I was telling you earlier about a hustling call, a telemarketing call I had today, and I discovered that the man was calling me from Madras in India, and the signal was much better than this man's signal, which I assume is coming from someplace in the Chicago area. 591-7200 is the number. We've now got a number of lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, do certainly try again. 591-7200, and we will return directly after this. And speaking of our audio archive, we will put this program up on that archive. It may be 3 or 4 days before it is available, but then you will find it if you just go to WGNradio.com and then click on my name, which takes you to the WGN website, and then click on Audio Archive, and there you are. And if you want to recommend this program to others who weren't listening tonight, then you can direct them just as I have directed you, and they will be able to hear it into perpetuity. 591-7200 is our number, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt. First of all, you answered that one question was whether this would be archived, so I appreciate that. I have a question. I've only heard parts of the show, so I don't know if this has been addressed, but I'm kind of curious as to the legal standing or the degree of autonomy that the various tribes have. In Wisconsin here, I know the Menominee Nation has their own license plate issued.
Where are you calling from, sir?
From Wisconsin.
Which town?
Between Milwaukee and Madison.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I've read in the past that the Iroquois Nation issues their own passport for international travel so that those people have dual citizenship. I'm wondering if all the tribes have the same standing and just what that is, and if not, why not? And kind of a related question, the Seminole are, I've heard, unique in that they were never defeated, and I wonder if they have any special standing.
Well, that's a fascinating question.
Well, certainly, I mean, different tribes have different status and standing, and a lot of it depends upon how they're recognized. I mean, for many groups and communities, the big goal nowadays is to get federal recognition, and they're working to that. Some groups are recognized by states, some are recognized by the federal government. Once they do get that federal recognition, they have a limited amount of sovereignty, and the more and more sovereignty is what people are always looking for in terms of control. Financial issues hold some sovereignty back. Economics is a big part of that. But increasingly, people are starting to, you know, push for more and more sovereignty overall.
So it relates to just how much of a push they put on in the past as to what they have.
Some are exerting things more and more, and clearly in the last 20 years, people are pushing that, you know, to basically have control of their own futures.
Okay, so and as far as the Seminole goes, they do not have anything... any special status or whatever, do they, because of their situation never having been actually defeated?
I don't know that theirs is different than other federally recognized tribes, but, and there are different branches. I mean, some of the Seminoles, of course, stayed in Florida is what you're talking about,
right,
and weren't relocated. I mean, there are other groups who probably would claim similar things. But
okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
We thank you, sir.
Sure.
Gentlemen, let me read you one email. It is now customary to portray Indians as fairly peaceful and in harmony with nature in a condition of balance that was disturbed by the arrival of the white man. Is it not true, however, that the Sioux, Lakota, etc., were viewed with alarm and fear by their neighboring Indians, who in turn tried very hard to convince Lewis and Clark to furnish them with guns in order to defend themselves from the Sioux? Indians could also be diverse, some preying upon others, some not so harmonious and in balance. The concept that Lewis and Clark perhaps naively believed was that commerce would overcome the need for violence and internecine warfare.
I think that's a fair observation, that Lewis and Clark were rather naive when it came to understanding the relationships between the various tribes. And as they came up the Missouri River, each tribe saw them as a group that could benefit them, maybe with trade or ideally with weapons. And they would then use those weapons against the other tribes. The tribes, of course, fought each other vigorously and often. And the initial confrontation they had was with the Teton Sioux as they went up the river, and that was because the Sioux were afraid that if Lewis and Clark proceeded further up, they would then proceed to arm the Arikaras and the Mandan and Hidatsa against them. And so it was already sort of an arms war in miniature that was taking place. And the Europeans had horses. Now they had guns.
I mean, clearly, we're looking at complicated international relations similar to all parts of the world and everywhere. I mean, some people fault native peoples for not all unifying. I mean, clearly, Europe doesn't unify all the time. So there's a lot of relationships that are going, and it has to do with trade. It has to do with land base. And clearly, when the Americans are coming and sort of prompting some groups to move, it leads them into different territories, and it leads to a real complicated international relation.
One of my views in that book on explorers that you mentioned, Milton, was the fact that both in Africa and the United States, the explorers had the advantage to some extent because the tribes in both of these areas were fighting each other almost as much as they were fighting the explorers, which gave them carte blanche into much of their territory and used one tribe against the other.
We have the same situation in the conquest of Mexico. It's commonly misunderstood that Cortes came in there with just a few dozen men and conquered Tenochtitlan and suppressed all of Aztec civilization. But in fact, he was accompanied by coastal tribal groups who were in continuing conflict with the Aztecs.
Who were often sacrificed for the god Huitzilopochtli, for the Aztec god of war.
Yeah.
Going back to the Lewis and Clark tale, I'd be interested in what the other panelists think about the reputation of the Blackfoot tribe. The only incident of violence on the Lewis and Clark expedition was a gunfight that broke out in northern Montana on the Two Medicine River with a couple of teenage Blackfeet boys. And then after the expedition, it was often said that the reason that this tribe had been so hostile to the Americans was it all went back to this one firefight on the river. And the more you read about that, the more that seemed maybe that wasn't really the case. It was a far more complicated situation, and the Blackfeet had other reasons to be concerned about Americans than the one grudge they had against Lewis and Clark.
And gentlemen, let us return to the phones. 591-7200, the number. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I had a quick question, because if you're getting close to the end yourselves. It's whether or not...
I hope not.
Well, not the ultimate end. My question is whether we are to finally look upon Clark's contribution as positive or negative. Currently, it's customary to see the arrival of white men as all bad for the Indians. But as we read Undaunted Courage and some other research, it suggests that people like Clark, well, Clark in particular, who tried very hard to learn Indian languages, he seemed to have tried to negotiate for trade. I think he was the first superintendent of Indian affairs. He insisted on remaining in the West close to the Indians to do that job rather than living in Washington. I guess he raised Sacajawea's son, and my understanding was that we were pretty much at peace with the Western Indians during his tenure in office. So that sounds good. I understand about the removal. That sounds bad. But the feeling that I understood was that he did this in conjunction with Jefferson, as they feared the whites overwhelming the Indian culture. So what is the current understanding of his real attitude and sympathy with the Indians, and how are we to look at his contribution now?
You know, you say this all with so much expert assurance. I get a sense that you may well be a direct descendant of William Clark. Is that right?
You read my email.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I don't know whether I'm supposed to be proud of that or not. I wish I were accomplished myself. Well, so yeah, he did all that. I wish I could do.
You should certainly be proud of it. The Clark, not only William Clark, but he came from a very distinguished patriotic family. In fact, I wonder if you were at the recent reunion of Clark family descendants that was in Locust Grove, the family homestead in Louisville, Kentucky.
No, alas, I was unable to make that, but that would be something to do.
In any event, I am midway through a biography of Clark, and my own feelings are somewhat vexed about Clark,
yeah.
And as I think his were about Indians themselves. He liked Indians individually. He played power, ruthless politics with them as tribes.
Mm.
And you just sort of have to come to grips with that. He was extremely humane and compassionate during the expedition. The Indians sought him out. He was their great doctor. He went to their aid many times. The Kagawea obviously was very fond of him. He did indeed raise their son Pompey and educated him.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that the result of his actions was not a happy one, and I think Clark struggled unsuccessfully himself with trying to make of his fate and theirs.
Ma'am, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
A very
interesting
contribution.
591-7200,
and there's room on the board for more calls. We will move rather quickly. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, good evening. Okay. I had a quick question. I read the book "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee" by Dee Brown quite some years ago, and it really affected me greatly. Kind of shattered my conceptions on the settling of the West and how it was done. And I'm kind of wondering what the panel thought about the book as a historical work. Or
well, Robert Galler is actually, you've worked up there, haven't you?
Where's that? I've worked out in Sioux Country, yes.
And Wounded Knee is a Sioux.
Wounded Knee is site. Very close to Pine Ridge, where I used to work, actually. But it's a seminal work. Clearly, when it comes out, along with probably Vine Deloria's Custer Died for Your Sins, I mean, books that are coming out in the late 60s and 70s kind of changed the whole historical scholarship or put a different light into it, trying to see American Indian history actually from an American Indian perspective, and that's, I think, the subtitle of it, American Indian Manifesto. But I think that book really starts to change things, and other groups have followed from there. But it tries to bring in Indian voice, which is what current scholarship's trying to do, and tries to bring things from some different perspective. I mean, people can critique it now in other ways as well, but at that point it really changed the nature of how people are writing about American Indians.
And another caller, good evening, you are on the air.
Hi, I wondered if anyone knew anything about the Catawba Indians. When we lived in Charlotte, North Carolina, about 50 years ago, we were privileged to go to a farm of a gentleman that went to our church and actually saw a village site that apparently they had all died off. But I wonder if there are any more details about that.
How do you spell Catawba?
I think it's either C-A-T-A-U-B-A or A-W-B-A.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's with a W. But, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of groups that people have talked about, and often the historical record, Native peoples disappear in their record, but doesn't necessarily mean the people are. And I think probably in most cases, I presume Catawba included, I mean, groups and people continue on, maybe not in the same places they were, and it gets into the complicated issue of identity that, we've talked about as well. But, I you know, certainly Catawbas are still around.
Well, what we were told that this particular group that was on this farm, at least, died off of some European disease to a man.
Oh, I mean, certainly diseases had a big impact in a lot of communities, and maybe that particular division was terribly hit. Maybe certain families were, but I mean, that doesn't necessarily, you know, constitute the whole group.
Yeah.
Sir,
but
we thank you.
Very interesting to dig arrowheads out of the riverbank.
Right.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
And time is short. I'm just wondering, though, you know, Churchill, following Carlyle, I guess, says history is really the record of the doings of great men, great historical actors. Who are some of the great historical actors that we haven't yet mentioned tonight who should be on the record?
Well, certainly Andy Jackson and his position on the Indians in the 1830s, the whole Texas experiment, the Revolution, the Republic. Sam Houston certainly be one of the pantheon figures. Mulholland in California, opening up the waterworks that makes Los Angeles work. There are many people, Buffalo Bill, Wild Bill Hickok, soldiers like John Charles Fremont, Kit Carson. There's a whole panoply of names that we can
Most mention. Of these guys have towns or cities named after them.
Many do,
yeah.
As the Buffalo does.
Yeah.
I would agree, especially in the case of John Charles Fremont. His wife, Jessie, once said to him, all your campfires have become cities, and indeed they had.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in Indian country, there are any number of people who are leaders, and we've talked about a bunch of them, people like Red Cloud, people like Spotted Tail. They're important people on the plains. I'm showing my bias there. But obviously, lots of communities had important people that really were negotiating in really complicated times. And the fact that, I mean, the population figures today show Native communities rising suggests that these people helped them negotiate that and actually, you know, bring them into the current times. So it's helpful.
What's a major available that is accessible? Popular history that of the settling of the West generally and all of the different aspects of it that you would recommend?
Well, Walter Nugent did a book on the people of the West, In the People or something within the people as a title. Ray Billington did some excellent works on the 19th century West. Walter Prescott Webb, of course, with his Great Plains study of Texas. And I think you have to look at Frederick Jackson Turner's thesis, The Significance of the Frontier in American History, mm-hmm. to begin it all. That's the founding father of this whole area.
A couple other important Western historians, Patricia Limerick, Richard White, have both done more recent works on that, and they would be important to look at as well.
And gentlemen, with that, we come to the end of the available time. Thank you for a most interesting evening. I've much enjoyed it. And as I said, we will put this up on the audio archive. It'll be there in a few days. Our guests have been Landon Jones, who is working on a biography of William Clark, Robert Geller, interim director of the Darcy McNicholas Center for American Indian History at the Newberry Library, and an old friend of ours, Richard Van Orman, professor of history at Purdue University, the Calumet campus, whose books is the one titled The Explorers, 19th Century Expeditions in Africa and the American West. We'll be back again tomorrow night. A special program on the art of cooking with three of Chicago's leading chefs, Paul Bartolotta, Jean Joho, and Rick Bayless. That's tomorrow at 9. And I must tell you, next Monday night, the return of Jackie Mason. Until tomorrow at 9, a cordial good night to all.